This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last night, Republican candidates running to unseat Democrat Kay Hagan participated in a televised debate that should have been a wake-up call for voters who may not be thinking much about the midterm elections in November or the May primaries, early voting for which begins tomorrow. But we've been thinking about it, and today we'll try to get you up to speed on the races, the issues, what the candidates have been saying about the issues, and about each other. We're joined by Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history and provost of Catawba College, Dr. Eric Heberling, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and the Charlotte Observer's Jim Morrill, one of the paper's longtime political reporters. Welcome back to you all.
Good morning.
Thank you.
First, we start with the question of the day. Where is my newspaper this morning?
Probably the same place mine is, and I don't know where that is either.
So we don't know what's going on?
No.
Okay. I thought maybe the truck broke down, the one truck that's left.
Ouch.
All right. Let's start with the debate last night. The biggest race in the primaries has got to be the GOP candidates running to unseat Kay Hagan, although only Republicans and independents can vote in that particular primary. They debated last night. This is the first televised debate, but have they debated before?
Well, they've had some debates, but Tom Tillis has been very selective in terms of where he's shown up. So this was the first time that really, I guess you could consider the top tier of candidates showed up in one place and debated for an hour.
Yeah, Tom Tillis has been very selective in deciding where he would appear. Why is that? Is it because it's his race to lose?
Yeah, he's following a classic front-runner strategy where you rely on your name recognition, you rely on your elite endorsements, you rely on your fundraising ability, and don't present opportunities to make mistakes, which would allow your opponents to catch up on you. So appearing in a debate is one of the more risky things a front runner can do, because that's where you can say things that you can't pull back very easily, or you have a Rick Perry moment and totally blank out and leave dead space and look stupid, or you allow your challengers to raise their status by just appearing on stage with you and seeing that they know policy at the same level that you do.
And Jim, since I know you cover these for a living, lucky you, you've been to a lot of these conversations among the candidates running for Senate on the GOP side of the aisle. Did the presence of television cameras change the tenor of the conversation at all last night?
Well, it might have a little bit, to the extent that I think a lot of the candidates had been more critical of Tom Tillis for not showing up at other debates and other forums. You didn't see a lot of that last night. You saw Greg Brannon, who's a doctor from Kerry and a Tea Party-backed candidate, go after Tillis quite a bit. But I think going back to what Eric said, that you saw part of Tillis' strategy on display last night. He virtually ignored his Republican rivals and criticized Senator Hagan, the Democrat, time after time after time, said she was failing the people of North Carolina on Obamacare and any other issue.
Obamacare came up a lot. They're all opposed to it. All of the people in the debate last night are opposed to Obamacare. Are they all saying that they would act in some way to repeal it? Or has that ship really sailed? Is that like some of the old issues that they'll just beat and beat and beat, even though there's no chance it's ever going to change, but it's good with the base?
I thought it was constant repeal, and there wasn't any real sense of how they were going to replace it, other than they were just using it as kind of the stick that they were hammering away on the president with. And so a lot of it was, we don't like it, we don't want it, we're going to repeal it. And even though they're probably the likelihood is Republicans won't get to a veto override number in the Senate, they still hammered on it. And I think that's going to be the common refrain from now until November.
But the longer Obamacare goes on, the hope of the Democrats is that the longer that it goes on, the more popular it will become, because people will realize they can see a doctor. Do you think that's true?
I don't know, because most people aren't directly affected by it. And I think, therefore, that the way they evaluate Obamacare is based on their pre-existing ideology. So in a Republican primary, you're pretty safe. You know that that everybody in, who's voting in a Republican primary hates it, so you just beat on it, and you don't have to come up with an alternative that might make you more credible in a general election. And I think even in the general election, they're not going to risk proposing alternatives because Republicans disagree on what the alternative should be.
Dr. Heberle mentioned a second ago, Jim, that Tom Tillis, it was his race to lose, and therefore he's acting like the front runner. Is he the front runner?
Well, I think he's definitely got the most money. He's raised the most money. He's on the air. The other candidates have just begun going on TV and in a more limited way, much more limited way. And, Tillis is targeting Senator Hagan in his commercials and in the debate. And, so have outside groups. Outside groups on his behalf have plugged him. Americans for Prosperity have plugged Tom Tillis in their commercials as independent expenditures. They've gone after Senator Hagan in the same way. So he's being consistent with what's out there. So I think you'd have to consider him, the guy to beat right now.
We know Tom Tillis because he's the Speaker of the House in North Carolina's legislature. He's also from Huntersville, I believe. We also know in Charlotte, at least, Mark Harris because he's the pastor at First Baptist Church. How unusual is it for a working pastor to be running for political office? Is it?
It's pretty unusual. Mike Huckabee was governor. Was a former governor when he ran for president, and I don't know that
He wasn't a working pastor at the time.
No, not at the time.
So does that give him a leg up, even outside of Charlotte? Because although maybe people in the eastern part of the state don't know who Mark Harris is particularly, I can identify with his Southern Baptist platform.
Sure. I mean, rural areas, I think, in the state are going to have a natural affinity in that context. You also have to remember he was one of the main organizers of Amendment 1 2 years ago that basically defined marriage in the state, and that's now under attack, particularly when the Fourth Circuit rules, however they choose to rule on the Virginia law. That's also going to affect North Carolina. So I think he's got a kind of ready-made audience with social evangelical conservatives. And I think what the primary is showing is the splintering and the factions within the modern Republican Party, that Tillis is kind of the mainline establishment candidate. Harris certainly is appealing to the social evangelicals. And then you've got Dr. Greg Brannon, who's appealing to the Tea Party Rand Paul wing of the party. The question in my mind is, who can kind of cross over into another faction and perhaps relocate some of those voters into their camp, or will Tillis basically be it by default? And, the best thing for him is to avoid the summer runoff to get 40% plus one in 2 weeks.
You wrote an article recently, Jim, about Mark Harris, Tom Tillis, and Greg Brannon, and probably about all of them, but you said in that article that those are the three best funded of the GOP candidates. Tell us a little bit about these. There are four candidates, right?
Well, there are eight candidates.
Excuse me. That's exactly right. There are eight candidates. So tell us a little bit about the people who debated last night, and then we'll go down the list of the other candidates.
Well, Tom Tillis, who is arguably the best known and the best clearly the best funded of the eight Republicans. And then you have Dr. Mark Harris, the pastor here, and Greg Brannon. And because Greg Brannon has Tea Party support and has been endorsed by Rand Paul and Utah Senator Mike Lee, another Tea Party favorite, he's got some national recognition. Mark Harris is still, I think, struggling for recognition across the state. And then you have Heather Grant, who's the only woman in the race, and she's a nurse from Wilkesboro. And she was in the debate last night. I was talking to Dr. Bitzer. I think this is the first time I can recall where you've had two clear tiers of candidates running for the Senate, and the two tiers that are recognized by TV stations. There's a debate in Raleigh tonight with the same four candidates who we saw last night, and then there's a debate tomorrow night with the other four candidates.
Let's talk about that tier, because you wrote on our blog, our political
party
blog,
line.
Party Line, that the eight GOP Senate candidates hoping to take on Kay Hagan in the fall into three tiers, and the only one that falls into the top tier is Tom Tillis. What are the three tiers? How do you put people into those slots.
Jim and Eric talked about, I mean, a lot of it is financial resources, the kind of money, the outside influence that is certainly becoming more prevalent in campaigns today. They're basically endorsing Tom Tillis, Americans for Prosperity, Karl Rove's group. And so you've got kind of the mainline establishment. Mitch McConnell is supporting Tom Tillis in this. And so that brings a lot of credibility to him. But also, he's run campaigns before. He's Speaker of the North Carolina House, even though a lot of people may not necessarily recognize his position. And he stressed that, I think, last night in saying, well, as Speaker of the North Carolina House, a speaker, that goes a long way to certainly building a kind of infrastructure that you need to run a statewide campaign. The second tier is kind of the next factions within the Republican Party, and that's the Tea Party influence as well as social evangelicals. And you've basically got candidates that represent those two critical wings.
So last night you had Tom Tillis from Tier 1. Were the other three from Tier 2, in your opinion?
Yeah, but I mean, they're all kind of bunched together. I mean, Tillis is always leading, but he's not leading by very much in the polls. I mean, his average is typically around 20-25%. The others are at 15%, 13%, maybe 11%. And then the others are in very low single digits.
And that third tier, you say, those are the vanity candidates. Those are the people that were not on television last night. Is that
right?
They
were not on television.
And by vanity candidates, what do you mean?
They're getting limited vanity, apparently.
They're very, very limited. I mean, we've got I believe former mayor of Shelby that's running, Ted Alexander, some others that are basically just in it for themselves to either fulfill some great destiny that they think they have to be the next U.S. senator from North Carolina or whatever. I mean, it's
perhaps this is a question better asked of Time Warner Cable and News 14 because they produced last night's debate.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have eight candidates running for the United States Senate on the GOP side of the aisle, why aren't all eight candidates invited to be at the debate?
Well, they had criteria for the debate last night, just like WRAL had criteria for the debate tonight in Raleigh. And that the criteria for the debate last night at Davidson was 7% of the in polls. They had three polls, and a candidate had to get at least 7% in the polls, and that was limited to the four candidates.
Dr. Bitzer mentioned a second ago that Tom Tillis has Karl Rove and Mitch McConnell in his corner, which makes him an establishment candidate. But what does that do to the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party? Does that automatically say, well, if you have Karl Rove's support and Mitch McConnell's support, I want somebody else?
Yeah, it can serve as a negative cue for them. That their beef is not just with the Democrats, but with the establishment wing of the party. So it's almost fighting words to bring those establishment groups in. The problem for them, especially in the first round of the primaries, is that because of the splintering of the opposition to the establishment, and you have eight candidates to split that seven candidates to split the anti-establishment vote, it's hard to overcome the establishment candidate, at least in round one.
But because you have money from Karl Rove's PAC and other Republican strongholds of money, bastions of money, and because we know that it's all about money today, how much money you have for television advertising, things like that, if you have that money, can you lose?
Yes, because a lot of that money is being spent on voters who aren't going to show up at the polls for a primary. You have a very small sector of the electorate who's going to show up, and your ability to get them out depends more on organizational grassroots campaign things. So having a Tea Party network or a church network could help.
Dr. Eric Heberlings with UNC Charlotte, Dr. Michael Bitzer with the Catawba College, and Jim Morrill with the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, nonprofit supplier to 22 of the region's hospitals. Only donors can meet the area's constant need for blood. CBCC.us. And Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Kenny Loggins, the Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter and guitarist, brings his musical passion to Belk Theater on Sunday. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Quentin Talley is dedicated to telling the African-American experience through original plays with his local company On Cue Performing Arts, and he's being mentored by the nation's leader in the black theater experience, Lou Bellamy of the famed Penumbra Theater in St. Paul. Both men will be here to share their unique theatrical thrust, and then we get a quick lesson in contemporary art. Perhaps you found yourself looking at something and going, I could do that, or I don't understand what that is. Well, we'll find out how you can better understand it tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Supreme Court upholds a Michigan voter initiative that bans racial preferences in the state's public universities. The future of race-based admissions.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's on the ballot in the May primary, which is looming large. And last night was the GOP senatorial debate on News 14. There'll be another one tonight from televised by WRAL in Raleigh. Will it be seen here?
Well, it'll be streamed. Yep. So I think people can watch it on WRAL.com.
Okay. The GOP candidates want to avoid a runoff because those runoffs would be in the summer, mm-hmm. middle of beach season. And if you think the turnout in May is bad, the turnout in July might be really bad, and that would cause an unpredictable nature to the outcome of a runoff. What has to happen to avoid a runoff possibility?
One of the candidates has to get 40% of the vote in the first round of the primary.
And how likely is that to happen?
It seems pretty low at this point, given the polls. But, you know, the polls here, again, are a bit misleading because it's really hard to predict who's going to turn out in these things.
You said candidates want to avoid a runoff. I think some candidates probably would welcome a runoff for that very reason.
Well, the leading candidate would like to avoid a runoff.
Yes.
Tom Tillis, yeah.
But the other candidates would probably like a runoff because if they have dedicated followers, dedicated supporters, they can motivate them to turn out on July 15th where other people wouldn't.
But doesn't it pose a challenge for any of the candidates, given the fact that when you have a runoff, there's a lot at stake because this is your last gasp effort mm-hmm. to win. So don't they start saying things about each other that they might not say, and that would damage the winner going into the general election, wouldn't it?
I think you may see that tonight and you may see it Monday night in the UNC debate. I thought last night was a very civil debate mm-hmm. in comparison to what we've seen in the past. I mean, Brannon went after Tillis and Harris got in his last comments, kind of a shot across the bow of both Tillis and Brannon. But they really played nice for the audience, I thought. Tonight and maybe Monday night may be their last chances to really start to attack each other. And that's where I think the gloves may come off. And that's where you potentially give the ammunition to the other side.
According to your article in the paper this morning, which I didn't get, I'll repeat that.
Thanks for repeating that. Just to let us know.
Brannon and Tillis really kind of were they were going at it last night in the debate, correct?
Well, Tillis deflected most of Brannon's comments and what seemed to go out of his way mostly to say he agreed with Brannon on certain things. There was one time where he just called him, you know, or said what he said was a patent lie. But he just went after Kay Hagan. So in a sense, he sort of tried to ignore his rivals.
Now, Brannon is a Tea Party. He's from the Tea Party wing of the party, and he wants to abolish a lot of things in the federal government. Of course, what one senator can do, even with a majority in the House and Senate, is limited. But he wants to abolish the IRS. He wants to abolish, health and education?
The Federal Reserve.
Which is not really a government organization, is it? It's kind of a quasi-government thing. Can you do
independent.
That?
It's independent, yeah.
But there were a lot of things that he wanted to abolish. Why even bring those things up if you really – that's not going to happen?
Well, I think it shows where he's coming from. It tells the people who support him that he's a constitutionalist.
Do we know how, for instance, he would run the government, how he would support the government, how he would pay for the military, et cetera, with no IRS?
I don't know that, but I know that he would turn over a lot of – he believes most of what the federal government does now is really in the purview of states, and he would turn over a lot of those responsibilities back to the states.
One of the big mantras that he had was, you know, Article 1, Section 8, that basically lays out the powers that Congress and by extension the federal government has in terms of what they should be doing specifically. He is, as he said, a constitutional conservative, whereas Tillis said, look, I'm a practical conservative. You have to recognize that there are some things that the federal government does do that is needed. But he, but Brannon's belief is shrink the size of the federal government, and that fits into the Tea Party ideology.
And because of his beliefs and what he espoused last night in this debate, it seems to me a lot of Tea Party people would be very attracted to him and to be prone to vote for him. Are the things that he espouses about the Constitution accurate?
Well, in terms of the list of things that are there, but it ignores the necessary and proper clause that follows right after that.
And that clause is what?
That says that Congress has the power to do all things necessary and proper for carrying out the listed functions, which the Supreme Court has interpreted very flexibly.
Essentially, last night he said, if it's not in the Constitution, I would get rid of it.
Right.
And what you're saying is that it is in the Constitution because of the necessary and proper.
And it also ignores the fact that the Constitution is setting up a process for making policy. It's not a policy document. It says that Congress, through the system of elected representatives, when you get a majority to vote on these things and the president to sign it, that makes the law. Now, the Constitution does provide some limits on that, but the fundamental purpose is that you allow elected majorities in the future, not in 1789, to be making decisions about what proper public policy
is. So explain to me what it is that the Tea Party people – what are they so upset with the government about? Why do they just think that we've gone too far afield from the Founding Fathers' ideals? Is that what they believe?
Part of it. I mean, a lot of it is taxed enough already, the belief that, you know, federal government taxes too much, takes too much, and seeks to redistribute in a way that does not acknowledge the power of the individual. And so, you know, this has always been a strain within American political thought of how much is it the focus of the individual, how much is it of all of us, the collective. And that's the tension that we see play out particularly within the Republican Party.
And so programs like the Affordable Care Act really get under their fingernails.
Oh, yeah.
Republicans in the State House made changes to early voting when they changed the election laws. And I'm just curious at whether those early voting changes are in effect for this primary.
It is. The week has shrunk, and the number of hours has to remain the same as in years past, but the number of days that people can cast early
ballots. So what impact might that have on the Republican primary?
Well, in Mecklenburg County, actually, the number of hours has increased from a couple of years ago, and even from the comparable election in 2010. But there are other changes, too. No longer can you the straight party ticket is not for the primary but for the fall. But there's no same-day registration anymore. People are going to be asked for IDs, and if you don't have one, you can fill out an application, or one will be filled out for you to get one. So there will be some changes.
Would you get that on voting day? I mean, can you vote that day?
You can vote without an ID this year.
Okay. Yeah. That goes until
2016.
Okay.
Yeah. But they're going to ask you anyway.
Okay. And how does early voting – historically, how has early voting impacted primary races? Because it starts tomorrow. Early voting.
I don't think as much in primaries as in general elections, but what it does is for your candidate strategy, if you now have a shorter period of earlier voting, that condenses the amount of time you're really running your get-out-the-vote operation. It changes when you're timing the messages that you think are most persuasive, because if you add early voting over a two-week period, there's a very long time where you're trying to run the campaign on maximum final day emphasis, where now under a more concentrated period of time, that window is much shorter when you have to be at full strength.
Yeah. In 2008 and 2012, North Carolina saw 56% of its votes come in before Election Day. I looked back in some of the numbers, and 80% of primary votes come on Election Day. So really, it's kind of a general election activity that people love, But in the primary, it's not so much.
Is that because most people know that a lot of people don't turn out for the primary, so they're not going to have to stand in a long line on election day, so we might as well wait till election day. Is that why?
I think it's a function of the level of information that yeah. voters have. In a general election, most people know well before election day that they're – which way they're going to vote. Where in a primary, because it's all candidates of the same party and they all have very similar beliefs, you have a lot of uncertainty
yeah.
about who you're going to vote for. So you're going to delay that vote choice.
And there are also more orchestrated efforts in a general election to get people out early. Look at the Obama campaign in 2008 and 2012 and Republicans to a greater extent last time too in the presidential race. There's an effort to get people to the polls, and they had Sunday early voting, which doesn't exist anymore, at least during this primary. But they had Sunday early voting, and you had saw things like Souls to the Polls, where churches would take people to the polls right. and make it an event.
So who votes in these primaries?
The activists, the people that are really hardcore Republicans or hardcore Democrats.
And that would mean people in many cases on the extreme left and the extreme right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
plus a few in the middle.
In North Carolina, I don't think most people know that independents can vote. They choose which party primary to vote in,
right.
but it's a very low number who participate just because people perceive it's a party event, and thus independents would be excluded.
You've said, Michael, that the May primary election is typically the definitive election for many contests, especially in the North Carolina General Assembly, and it will be a skewered electorate that determines the winners even before the voters in the general election get their say. Mm-hmm. So that makes primaries pretty important, doesn't it?
Sure. They are – I mean, the South is actually reimagining and redoing what it did when it was the solid Democratic South, 100 years ago. That was the Democratic primary was the deciding election for all the offices across the South. And now what we're seeing is because of redistricting and where people tend to live, that is, again, the primary is becoming the core election that determines who wins already before a vote is cast in November.
And because the true partisans, be they Democrat or Republican, be they left or right, come out for the primaries because they really have a horse in the race. Mm-hmm. They have big stakes. It's big stakes for them. And because now they know mm-hmm. that they determine the winner. Does that hurt Tom Tillis?
It depends on how he presents himself, and I think he certainly showed that he was a conservative. Mm-hmm. He wanted to stress that he was a practical conservative in comparison to others, so that may put him a little outside of the extreme right within the Republican Party. But another classic example, I think, is the 12th Congressional District. You had candidates yesterday saying they wanted – the Democratic candidates wanted to double – the minimum wage
yes.
Level right now. In November, a Democrat is going to win the 12th Congressional District. I'm sorry to the two Republican candidates. Vince Coakley is one of them. But, when 79% of that district votes for Barack Obama, that district is going to elect a Democrat. It doesn't matter who.
That's Mel Watts' old seat.
Mel Watts' old seat, yeah.
Voting is usually down in off-year elections. So how does that impact the primaries in off-year elections, even when there are Senate candidates running and House candidates running?
Yeah, it's going to be low. There's no doubt about it. And particularly if this goes into a runoff, it becomes very unpredictable just because the turnout is so low and there's very little guide as to who's going to be showing up.
But Republicans really don't like Kay Hagan, the Democrat incumbent in the Senate. With her presence on the ticket in November, will that increase the turnout or increase people's need to go to the May primary to put the right candidate in place to run against her?
Well, some people will think so and they'll go vote, but they would have voted anyway. So I don't think it'll increase the primary turnout significantly. But yeah, you're right. There'll be a lot of interest in November. And not only is do people have strong feelings about Senator Hagan one way or the other, mm-hmm. but it's a significant election in America. The Republicans need to pick up 6 seats to gain control of the Senate, which they haven't had for a few years. And this is one of the seats that's considered vulnerable and doable for Republicans.
I've seen some ads for Kay Hagan, or at least in mm-hmm. support of Senator Hagan, on television. And I'm curious as to whether, given that she's not in the primary, because she is the incumbent and there's no opposition on the Democratic side.
Well, there is.
Well, there is.
There are some small.
Well, okay. She's the incumbent. And she's
invisible vanity candidates.
Yeah. Okay. Given that, how unusual is it for this kind of money to be spent against an unknown Republican challenger?
Well, I think it's softening up the groundwork. I mean, it's basically allowing Kay Hagan to keep her war chest pretty substantial. I think she's up to $8 million.
No, it's more than that. It's like more than 11 that. Okay. or 12.
Okay. Wow. So she's got a pretty hefty war chest, and she can continue to build that going into the fall election. But she can have the surrogate PAC, Senate Majority PAC is one of them, that is targeting Tom Tillis to soften up for the general campaign.
And she has this significant war chest, I would presume, because Democrats and Democratic supporters are pumping money into it because this is a key state. They want to keep her seat for many reasons.
I think so, yeah.
I think you've seen more outside money spent here already than in any other state in the country.
And if I could follow up on that, I think the amount of money that candidates have and spend is going to matter a whole lot less than it used to, just because you have so many outside groups spending money. What we've seen over the last decade, even candidates' proportion of the total spending in a race is a fraction of it. The party groups in outside interest groups are spending more than the candidates are. So we're going to hear a lot more from people trying to affect the race than from the candidates themselves.
In fact, I think to follow up on that, I think Senator Hagan just began a round of TV, her first TV buy, whereas you've seen other Democratic allied groups go after Tom Tillis and Republicans for weeks and months.
And we don't know who the Republican challenger will be, but no matter who it is, what are the likely issues going to be in the Senate race in North Carolina?
Well, I think if Tillis is the GOP nominee, we're going to have a contest between Obamacare and the Republican legislature. We're going to hear a lot about cuts in teacher salaries, voter ID laws, things that are very unpopular with the Democratic base and some swaths of independent voters in North Carolina versus Obamacare. And as we've seen in the ads thus far, every possible opportunity of tying Kay Hagan to unpopular aspects of the Obama administration.
North Carolina seems to like to have one Democrat and one Republican in the Senate. Is there a rhyme or reason behind that? Or is that just happenstance over all these years? How do you see that?
I think it's just happenstance. I mean, for a long time, it was Jesse Helms that dominated on the Republican side. And certainly you had at times Republican senators in the other seat as well. But it tends to be a kind of back and forth. And I think that indicates, again, North Carolina is kind of statewide, a kind of unstable swing, from one way to the other that we've seen in recent elections.
Is Kay Hagan, if she's reelected, is she going to be reelected by the urban areas of the state? And
that's where her base is. Yeah. And the big question in my mind is, can she benefited from the grassroots mobilization in 2008, the president of Obama. She doesn't have that now, and she's got to be able to get her base up because it is going to be a base election.
And doesn't she have to distance herself a little bit from the president at this stage?
Well, that's a strategic calculation she's going to have to make, whether it's better to stick with Obama and have an enthused Democratic base to turn out for her, or whether she distances herself trying to appeal to more independent voters.
There are some other races. There really are. We'll talk about them when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and My Fox Carolinas WJZY, interactive, informative, and new. My Fox Carolinas is on TV, on mobile devices, and on the web at myfoxcarolinas.com. And McGay Shepherd, certified financial planner and senior vice president of investments at Stifel Nicolaus, with 25 years experience. Stifel is a national brokerage firm providing investment services since 1890. Stifel.com. The Supreme Court upholds a Michigan voter initiative that bans racial preferences in the state's public universities. The future of race-based admissions, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. I want to jump into our conversation about the May primary. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start.
It doesn't matter who calls. It could be the lottery commission, the hospital, the IRS. It doesn't matter, because you're listening to Snap Judgment from NPR, and they are just going to have to wait.
It's a new episode of Snap Judgment every Saturday afternoon at 3. Repeat it Friday evenings at 10 at 90.7 WFAE. And you can stream us at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Michael Bitzer is here from Catawba College. Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte. Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer. What happened in Family Circle today? Because I didn't get the paper.
Chris, I'll bring it to your house.
Thank you.
Jim Morrill, call your office.
Chris emails, what is up with the letter poorly written in the Raleigh News and Observer attacking Tom Tillis by North Carolina Representative Robert Brawley? Are you familiar with this? I'm not.
Yeah, I think I saw that. Yeah. That's an old feud that goes back. Robert Brawley's from Mooresville in Iredell County, and he's been at loggerheads with the speaker for a year. And part of it involves toll roads. Part of it's personality. So,
is he a pastor?
No. He's a Republican who's been in the legislature on and off for a long time.
Well, perhaps this is a comment that refers to the debate last night, because he goes on to say, honestly, the statement from the pastor was bizarre. God gives us our rights, not government. What's the point of participating if that's how he feels? Is that something that Mark Harris said last night?
Well, I think he did. But I think he and Greg Brannon both were talking about the rights and the Bill of Rights being God-given rights and not government-given rights.
And, well, isn't that the whole premise of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution? Inalienable rights. That didn't come from the king. They came from God, right?
Right.
Do your guests know anything about Will Stewart and Ernest T. Reeves, the Democrats running against Kay Hagan? Is there going to be a Democratic debate?
No and no.
No and no.
Why don't we know? Isn't it the response that and I don't know. Yeah, I'm putting myself in this camp. I have no idea who these people are. Is that irresponsible on our part in terms of being?
We did have a story about it last week. There was a story about Senator Hagan and the two Democrats who are opposing her, and it was sort of like mini profiles of them.
We've talked a little bit about why this primary is important in the Senate race, but there are other races. And you're saying, Jim Morrill, that the primary is going to be important in many of these races.
Yeah, there are several legislative seats in Mecklenburg County that for which the primary is the race. There's a Senate district with Bob Rucho, the incumbent, who's got a Republican challenger in that race, but no Democrat in the race. So whoever wins the primary goes in. In Senate district in this area near UNCC, which Malcolm Graham has represented, Malcolm Graham now running for Congress, there are four or five Democrats running for that seat, and there's no Republican. So whoever wins that seat in 2 weeks wins the Senate seat.
And has there been a lot of noise, a lot of coverage in that particular House race, North Carolina House race, the Malcolm Graham seat?
No.
Or Senate race, rather?
No, there hasn't been.
But who's running against Bob Rucho?
Matt Arnold, he's a Republican lawyer.
Okay.
He's been around.
Is he more conservative, less conservative than Bob Rucho?
I think there's actually a story in the paper today about that. And since I didn't get my paper either, I haven't read it. But I think race is a referendum on Bob Rucho.
I wanted the paper because I wanted to get the rooms to go.
Yeah, what's interesting about that particular race is that most of the Republican primary challenges that you have to incumbents is coming from Tea Party types who are accusing the incumbents of being too squishy, too compromising, too moderate. Mm-hmm. And here you have a Republican challenger saying that Rucho is too inflammatory, too extreme. So it's a different strategy than we usually see.
Well, Senator Rucho is one of the proponents of taking the airport and away from the city and putting it into the hands of an authority. I'm wondering if that has gone over well with the electorate and how that stance would affect this race against this challenger.
It's certainly an issue that candidate Arnold is using and is saying that's feedback he's hearing from constituents that he talks to, that this came out of nowhere. Rucho has never really explained it, and therefore Rucho needs to be more accountable to his constituents for that.
But here's another case where the circumstances get sort of lopsided. There's no debate in that race. And, Senator Rucho, I'm sure, has a lot more money. He's also got the backing of the North Carolina Chamber. which is already sending out things on his behalf, and I don't think Matt Arnold has enough money to get that message out.
Before we move on to the House race, John emails, Mark Harris was a strong supporter. That's one of the people running, one of the front runners in the senatorial race. Mark Harris is a strong supporter of Amendment 1. If there is a runoff, what is his ability to turn out the Baptist and evangelical vote, and could that make him a more formidable opponent?
I think that's the great unknown. I mean, right now, I think what you're focused on is the grassroots mobilization. And we say, you know, that every vote counts, but when you're talking about elections where there may be 15-18% voter turnout, that matters even more. And I think that ready-made network that Reverend Harris can draw on, just like Greg Brennan can draw on the Tea Party network within the state, certainly will help him. Will it get him over that threshold and make him number two to Tillis and potentially go on to a runoff? We don't know.
Yeah, those networks are going to be critically important in a runoff election where most people don't even know they exist. So to have other people come to you and say, hey, there's a runoff election this day. You need to come. Will you go with me? That's a good chunk of your turnout.
Yeah.
And if you have those organizational structures that can get people to the polls in a low turnout election, that can be the difference.
In the 12th congressional district, which is Mel Watt's old seat, Mel Watt went off to be secretary of...
He went over Fannie and Freddie Mac.
Okay. There's been some pretty sharp exchanges. At least there wasn't a debate between George Battle and Senator Malcolm Graham. You wrote one recent forum, Jim, when Graham touted his experience and sending that experience to Washington, Battle said that Graham was right, that he, George Battle, didn't have any experience compiling one of the worst Senate's worst attendance records over the last 10 years and one of the worst effectiveness ratings. Them's fighting words.
Yeah, and that was the feistiest we've heard in that race between those two candidates, but it's true. I'm surprised that there hasn't been more about that. Senator Graham does have a record like two of the other candidates who've been in the legislature. Another issue that's divided people is school vouchers. There's one candidate, Marcus Brandon from High Point, who is a co-sponsor of a bill provide school vouchers of taxpayer money for students to use in private schools, poor students. And that's not what you hear from many Democrats, from most Democrats.
Has he been criticized heavily by the other candidates for that stance?
Yeah.
Minimum wage came up a bunch. They're all in favor of raising the minimum wage, some as high as, I think, $15 an hour.
Yeah.
How does that play in North Carolina? And I know it probably plays well in that district, 12th
district.
Well,
that's all they need. I mean, that's where the battle is. I mean, it's like you go to a Democratic debate in the 12th district and you go to a Republican Senate primary debate. It's like you're in alternate worlds. The Democrats were all praising Obamacare, saying it doesn't go far enough. Mm-hmm. Therefore, raising the minimum wage. Everything's on the other side in the Republican debate.
Of course, Democrats will vote in that primary. Republicans will vote in the other House District 12 primary. And you already mentioned one of the candidates, a former Channel 9 anchor Vince Coakley. Who's the other Republican?
Leon Threet. He's a pastor from Matthews, African-American pastor.
From Matthews. So everybody in the race is African-American because it's fundamentally an African-American district. In the general election, I mean, Vince Coakley is a pretty famous dude. He has a lot of name recognition out there and face recognition. In a contest among with the Democrat, does he have a shot?
Well, when Barack Obama won 79% in that district and Mel Watt won 79% of that district's vote, you know, I just can't see it happening.
I would think it would help Coakley do much better than typical Republican candidates in that district. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a lopsided district that getting 5 or 10% of the vote more than other Republicans doesn't get you the seat.
Well, he was not only a television anchor, in which he really didn't express his opinion. He was also a radio talk show host, in which he did express his opinion. And he's conservative. There's no question about that. That's not going to play in the 12th?
He hopes it will, obviously. But, you know, his message is a message of personal empowerment. It's almost libertarian more than Republican. And I don't know how well that'll play. I don't think it will.
So among the Democrats, who are the front-running Democrats in that race? Is it George Battle and Malcolm Graham, or are there others that we need to really think about?
Alma Adams is a representative from Greensboro, and she's the only woman in the race. Mm-hmm. And she's got tons of support from women's groups and other groups, labor unions. And so I think she's formidable. And then I think you'll have a runoff with one of the Charlotte candidates.
Yeah. A runoff?
This race will go to a runoff most likely in July. And the question is, Mecklenburg makes up 53% of the voters in this district.
Okay.
So, if you've got several Malcolm Graham battle splitting that vote, could somebody from Greensboro, from High Point, sneak in? I think it's one of those that it's flying under the radar and it's grassroots mobilization.
We talked about how – I'm sorry.
Well, and there's a lot of name recognition dynamics that are probably going to go on in this primary. Mm-hmm. And that plays to the regional differences within this district, that Alma Adams is the only Greensboro candidate in the race. So it's highly likely that she's going to get – most of those votes, where the Charlotte candidates, to the extent that voters know many of them are from Charlotte, are likely to split the Charlotte vote. So you could have winners based merely on that geographic dynamic of the race.
One thing today that may play into the race is that James Mitchell, who dropped out, James Smutsy Mitchell, who ran for mayor last year and lost, is endorsing George Battle today in a couple hours. So that may or may not make much difference in the race.
James Mitchell dropped out. He ran for mayor, lost to Patrick Cannon. His name came up in the decision to replace who they would replace Patrick Cannon with. But he dropped out because of money troubles. Why was he having money troubles? Why was his campaign having money troubles?
A couple of reasons. I think he started late for one, and other people had already gotten in the race gotten an early jump on that. And, I think the whole perception of him having run before and being interested in being mayor at the same time sort of diluted his support.
We haven't mentioned Curtis Osborne.
He's a lawyer, apparently an accomplished lawyer. He's poured $100,000 of his own money into his race. So he's a first-time candidate, born in public housing in Monroe. But he's trying.
We talked about the possible negatives of having a runoff in the Senate race for the Republicans. Is there a negative in having a runoff in the Democratic House race in the 12th District, or does it completely different rules apply there?
Besides making reporters work in the middle of summer?
is there a negative there?
Because there's no general election, really, that's going to be competitive. So they can rip each other to shreds, and it's not going to probably create any damage in the general election.
The 2010 census, the result of that is, in every district in the country, they redrew the districts. Mm-hmm. And is this the first election that this comes into play with, or was it the last one that came into play?
Last cycle,
2012. Yeah.
There are five Democrats running for three at-large seats on the Mecklenburg County Board of Commissions. Three are incumbents: Pat Cotham, who was briefly the chair, Trevor Fuller, the current chair, and Kim Ratliff, the vice chair under Pat Cotham. There are two newcomers, former five-term city council member Ella Scarborough and County Park and Recreation Commissioner Elaine Powell. Are there issues in this race that we should know about in Mecklenburg County?
I don't know that there are issues as much as just the dynamics of it. I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether Ella Scarborough can make a comeback. She was at the County Democratic Convention a couple weeks ago and just said, "I'm back." And she has been around a long time ago. But and then you had the board that sort of unceremoniously dumped Pat Cotham as chairman.
And that was Trevor Fuller, who's one of the candidates in this race. He was the one who kind of pushed for that, right?
Right.
According to David Perlmutt in The Observer, Cotham, Fuller, and Ratliff differ very little on the issues. What about the other two? Do we know?
Powell certainly emphasizes environmental issues based on her record with the parks and recs. But as a really first-time candidate, her main issue is that it's going to be challenging for people to find out about her. She doesn't have a whole lot of money.
And we also already know that the three Democratic frontrunners in the primary will face Republicans Emily – I hope I say this name correctly – Emily Zuyus, Z-U-Y-U-S, and Scott Carlisle in November. Are they in a primary race? Is there a
no,
Republican?
There's no Republican primary.
So, but there are two candidates? Why is
for that? Three seats.
For three seats.
Okay. So do we know anything about them or what they would want to do on county commission, how they differ from the Democrats, et cetera?
We know they will represent the Republicans on the fall ballot.
This is the problem with primary races, right here in a nutshell. Dan Klotfelter, he's vacated his seat in the legislature to become the mayor of Charlotte. Talk about the process of replacing Dan Klotfelter in the legislature.
Well, it's an interesting process and a weighty one, actually. He's got, 6 or 8 months left on his term this year, and he's on the ballot in November unopposed. So whoever is selected to replace him could serve until the next election. And it's the executive committee of the Democratic Party, the county Democratic Party, and there are 49 voters, and you've got three or four candidates out there campaigning for among these 49 votes. And so whoever gets a majority of 49 wins. It's the third time this year within the last year
right.
that a senator has been chosen this way.
Will he be on the ballot in November, or will they find a new candidate? They won't. How does it work?
Whoever is elected to replace him in the Senate to take his
seat
the rest of the term mm-hmm. will be on the ballot in November.
Jim Morrill's political reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history and the provost, we don't know what that means, at Catawba College, and Dr. Eric Heberlig, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate it.
We'll get your paper to you.
Okay, thank you very much. And bring the New York Times, so I didn't get that either. Same carrier. What's up with that?